This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today on the show, a retail-free alternative to Black Friday with a visit to a toy exhibit. And a fun activity to do by yourself or with friends and family. Thrifting for the holidays and beyond. Godzilla, Wonder Woman, Trolls, Princess Leia, Batman, and so many other pop culture icons dominate store shelves and fill our imaginations. David Barnhill is a passionate toy collector with one of the largest private collections. We're talking tens of thousands of pieces. Stephen Roof chairs the Arts Entrepreneurship Department at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. And like Batman and Robin, they teamed up. They may not be fighting crime, but they do wear fun outfits. And they're the force behind Super Monster City, a celebration of America's monsters, superheroes, and villains. That's an exhibit up now at the Yumcom Center in Moorhead. I took my weapon of choice, a Zoom H4n digital audio recorder, and checked it out.
What are we looking at?
Well, we put together an exhibition of David's toys. Now, we have posters, film clips, packaging, and toy objects, over 350 objects that you will see here at the Yumcom Center. They span about the last 60 years. The collection spans about 60 years worth of toys, objects, posters, games, interactive, and video clips.
How long have you been collecting?
I've been collecting my entire life, since like 1960, okay? Now, my parents endorsed and embraced any kind of interest that I had. So what they did is when I got into the Monster Kid movement of the early 60s and wanted all those monster models and all those monster toys, they just went out and got them all, sometimes doubles and triples. And my father worked at a television station, was a film editor. He put together all the film clips you're going to see here. He saved everything that had anything to do with monsters, villains, and superheroes. The toy commercials, the movie trailers, all that stuff. And then, of course, there was posters. And then, of course, my parents sometimes bought me doubles. And so one I would play with and one I would keep in the packaging. And so you're going to see a lot of original packaging. And my parents loved the idea that I was passionate about something that seemed innocent and fun and exciting, and so they never said no, and it's all here.
You must have felt very seen as a child.
Very well loved and very supported in everything and anything I wanted to do. So when I was shifting from monsters to superheroes, I could keep monsters and keep going on superheroes. So I have a collection of comic books, a collection of posters, a giant collection of toys, all the film clips. I've also got all the paraphernalia and bits and pieces, because I was always looking for the outlier toy or the oddball toy or the underdog toy that nobody else in the neighborhood would have. And my mom was incredible about that, said, great, if we saw it, we bought it.
Toys have this amazing ability to both be mostly overlooked in society in terms of their importance, but also omnipresent. Everybody gets a toy for 18 different holidays that we've decided to make up at any given time of the year. But we don't always stop and think about what the toys that are out at that time say about what our culture is thinking at that time, or even the possible impact of that style of play, what that might mean to us in the future. So the importance of this exhibit, we'll start with the fact that it is separated here into different sections. Unintended Consequences, The Atomic Age and America's Search for Identity is the first one. What is this section about?
Well, David has a collection of almost 200,000 toys. And as his friend from when we were in seventh grade together, so lifelong friends, and now I am a professor at a College of Art and Design in Minneapolis, I started to ask him, what do you want to do with all these toys? And he said, well, I'd like to get them out in the world. And I said, all right, let's do that. And I started to look through his collection, and we talked about different things. We started to sort them into stories. What stories can we tell about who we are as a country, where we've been, and might get some inkling about where we're going by looking at the toys and reflecting on the social and political contexts of different eras. So with unintended consequences, we're looking at what was society's response to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the end of World War II, what was the mindset of America, what was the attitude towards science. There was, the success of stopping or ending a very violent and very catastrophic war, and at the same time there were these unintended consequences of the impacts of dropping nuclear bombs. So some of that gets reflected in toys, because we have radioactive bugs and these giant spiders and incredibly growing women, 50-foot-tall women and things like that, that are the results of radioactivity. We also started to see what outer space and space exploration was going on in the late 1950s. And we started to be worried about, are germs going to come back from exploratory missions, and what's going to be clinging on the outside of a spaceship when it returns to Earth and things like that. And so we started to wonder and worry as a society about those things. And those anxieties show up in our popular culture. They show up in movies, they show up in television shows, and they show up in our toys. Now, part of that is fantasy. Space was a frontier. It was the place that we could explore. Our imaginations could run wild. We also, the Marshall Plan and who we were as Americans, we were actually helping navigate a new world order in the 21st century after the global economic collapse, with the exception of the U.S. And so we were able to guide others around the world. So our military might, our political foresight was able to sort of guide us. And we see that in the way that the military and government, American government, is represented in popular culture.
So you take fear of something like the A-bomb and you combine it with wild imagination, the first generation of people to really have a childhood following World War II. And what do we get from it? What are the toys from this era?
Well, the amazing thing is you've got radiation, which is the be-all, end-all in both comic books and toys and movies. It can do anything to anybody and make your wildest nightmares come true. And also at that moment, you've got this great frontier of space, and nobody can guess what's out there. The astronaut as hero is a great thing, but it's who he's going to meet out there and what they're going to be like. And for the most part, they're not friendly. And so that just brings a whole giant cornucopia of aliens and bugs and slithering things that come to Earth with bad purpose. They have hunger. They have wants, needs, and desires to conquer us and do whatever. And as kids, we just ate that up. It would be like, oh my God, this is evil. This is beyond human evil. This is outer space evil. And usually, through one way or another, we would win out in the end. But there was always another visitor coming our way. There was always going to be another visitor.
Not to give any spoilers here, but as we progress, we're going to see how the toys are changing and how we are including a little bit more humanity in some of those heroes and villains. And we're moving along to the next section here, Truth, Justice, and the American Way, Unifying a Country's Identity. And here we are focusing on Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. What are these characters sharing?
Well, Superman came from another planet. And he arrived here and suddenly discovered that he wasn't like everyone else around him. He had special powers, special insight, and had a deep commitment to the country that he arrived in, that saved him, that nurtured him, that cared for him. And to navigate the world, he also had to hide his true identity to then live among us, right? So he had to hide who he really was. And this is a metaphor that we pick up on here that talks about people who are becoming Americans and how do they both balance who they truly are and using those special powers for who they are in a way that actually helps them become Americans and helps the community in which they're living. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he's a reflection of who he sees us as. Clark Kent is how he sees adult men. Kind of boring, kind of plain, kind of simple, not really smart, a little bit easily duped.
You're the one who said it, yeah. Not me.
And so, you know, and that's, he's kind of making fun of us, you know. And so, but at the same time, it's what he does in order to be a true American, is that he's acquiescing to the dominant culture, acquiescing to our shared values. And that is embodied with the phrase truth, justice in the American way. Wonder Woman and Batman have their own journeys. Similarly, they have ways in which they try to navigate the world and try to be the ultimate Americans. That they try to. Wonder Woman is really an interesting character. She was originally created and to come to America and actually resolve conflict through peaceful means. That was the origins of Wonder Woman. So it was a nonviolent way, and that was her original message. Batman, you know, has a traumatic childhood. A lot of people in the 50s had traumatic childhoods. There was a lot of chaos in home life, and it was a really kind of a fraught era. And so Batman was a great opportunity for people to see themselves in a character that was able to wrestle with their inner demons and yet still be able to manage to do the right thing, make the right choice, and make sure that America was the thing that they were working to celebrate, strive, and support.
So in a way, we have an immigration story. An alien comes to this country, and then, like you said, those hidden identities. Very human experience, but maybe especially a very teenage and young adult experience as we're trying to figure out who we are, and we feel a little bit compelled to hide that. You're nodding. So the toys that are coming out of this era, obviously the Superman, the Batman, the Wonder Woman, what kind of change are we seeing besides the fact that they're not giant bugs here? Obviously much more human forms here.
The DC pantheon, we're talking mostly about. So DC starts with Batman and Superman in 1938, and they have this incredible cavalcade of characters. And of course, in the 40s, they're more interested in fighting spies. And then in the 50s, they're fighting communists. And then they almost get sort of homogenized to the point in the 50s, like we're talking about the sort of making them conform. And most superhero comic books crumble. That's a time when we have funny animal stories, Western stories, detective stories, and horror stories. So superheroes were struggling in the 50s to find their place. And the way that DC made it work was to sort of make them boring, to make them bland, to make them like, oh, great, let's, you know, Batman's just sort of like, we say, they're Boy Scouts in tights. They're just sort of wandering around, you know, fighting criminals. And, oh, every story, there's no continuing stories. There's no angst. There's no martyrdom. And the other thing that is nice about when superheroes come of age in late 50s is at that moment you've got the Western is the dominant sort of adventure play mode. You've got cowboys and Indians, and you've got maybe a little bit of police drama. But superheroes suddenly become a larger-than-life excitement. You know, you've got the monsters over, you've got, you know, big giant bugs, and now you've got colorful characters in capes. And as a kid, that dress-up aspect, the whole idea that you could be somebody. And we touched on Batman. So the thing about Batman was any one of us could have been Batman. Or Robin. All you had to do is train hard.
Yeah. Fight and hard. Have money.
Yeah, well, have money, okay. But, you know, you could be Robin. You could be adopted by Batman. You know, there you go. So we've got a lot of colorful characters here, and a lot of them have a long lifespan, and they're still enduring to today. And the great thing is, yeah, everybody knows who Batman is. They all know the backstory. We all know who Superman is. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of the DC universe, is it's come a long way.
Well, and we have that advent of Wonder Woman, and like you mentioned, that recognition of female wisdom and female strength and the assets that women bring to the table of it, we don't always need a violent solution. There can maybe be some diplomacy, but then, of course, when it's time to go and kick some butt, she can do that too.
Very well, yes. So DC, of course, has now really embraced a real diverse bunch of characters. You've got Wonder Woman, you've got Batgirl, we've got Dr. Light over there, Batwoman over in the other case, we've got Star Sapphire over there, Harlequin, of course. I mean, you've got lots of female characters working in tandem in that universe. We've also included a few different characters from other venues. The Phantom is a comic strip character that even predates Batman. We've got the Green Hornet over here, and that's a radio character, radio drama character that came out of the 30s. Yeah, we've tried to bring it all together so that everybody will find somebody they can identify with. Just looking over there, we've got the Rocketeer, who was sort of a retro history character that came out in the 80s. But everything's here, including the Shadow and a few others.
This little Robin over here in little short shorts, being of the sex and gender that is often sexually objectified, even in toy form. Let's talk about just even how we are dressing the superheroes and why that matters.
The thing about Robin, let's say, is originally he was a sidekick. He was probably the first child sidekick. And he made Batman less grim. He added the idea that kids could identify with a character, a true character, in that comic book. Up until that time, people had said, you know, you can't, we're not putting kids in these things. And suddenly that was a big thing in the 40s, kid sidekicks. Now, the skin issue, women have always been too hypersexualized in most of their costumes. That's changing now. They're not showing as much skin. It's being much more progressive. Even Robin now wears a much better costume.
Not a good look on most people.
No, it's not.
All right, we're going to progress over to the next section now, and this is called Innocent Monsters, Our Empathy for Outsiders. And in this last section, we talk about hiding your true identity, and this whole theme is one generation's fears and perhaps the next generation's rebellion, because suddenly we don't care about hiding our true selves.
Well, that's true. Empathy for outsiders is really what these monsters are. We all have a little bit of the outsider inside of us. We feel a little bit misunderstood. We're not quite accepted by our neighborhood or our friends or our society, like to show our full selves. And these characters, King Kong, werewolf, Frankenstein, they're really the embodiment of that taken to the nth degree, this idea of being misunderstood, trying to live toward your experience, your natural state of mind, and trying to live into that. Frankenstein didn't ask to be born. He was sewn together and then brought to life, and he has struggled to fit into society. In the book, he reads, he learns French, he's trying to be accepted. The only people that can accept him is a blind guy, because he doesn't see him as this horrific creature. He hears and knows him as a person. And so I think that teenagers especially go through a period where we want to be invisible. We feel like our inside doesn't match with what the world or our society expects of us. Our neighbors or our friends don't quite understand us. We identify with these characters that are being taken away from their natural habitat and thrust into a new structure, social structure, societal structure. And that's where the empathy for outsiders, for these iconic characters, really takes hold. And we can understand them. We can understand, as an outsider, you are not being understood, and you would love to be understood. You would love to be accepted in a way that you're not.
And we definitely, showing up in the toys here, you see outsiders portrayed very differently. These don't look anything like this last section of toys that looked pretty human.
What we've got here is monsters. An incredible wave took over America, the monster mania from about 1958 to, let's say, 1968. Monsters were everywhere. And the great thing about monsters as a kid and a collector was that they were larger than life. And they came with just enough backstory that you could create stories onward. So you knew the Frankenstein story, the Dracula story. Now let's blend those two stories together. Throw in the Wolfman, the creature, the mummy. And suddenly you had this sort of great monster opera happening in your backyard or in your sandbox. And all these guys were fighting. And they all had their own agendas. And they're all jealous. And they're all mad at each other. And they're just going crazy about it. And their monsters come in many forms. So there was monster trolls in this case, turning monsters into something cute and adorable. All kids like that thrill of excitement. So the monster movies give you that bit of a shudder maybe and a bit of a wow factor, because you've got guys turning into werewolves. You've got monster vampires turning into bats and flying away and sucking your blood. You've got giant gorillas pounding through the forest. And you just are like awestruck by the sheer power emanating from these characters. And as a kid, how could I not want to embrace them all, save them all, and take them all? And also, in this case, there were also some of the weirder monsters that didn't have a story, and that was even better because then you could, who was this guy? Let's make up a story about him that is all mine.
We got the next section here. With great power comes great responsibility. The hero as a martyr. I'm a mother. This martyr theme really sticks with me. What is this section about?
Well, again, if you think about Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, they weren't martyrs. They were happy, proud, in fact, enthusiastic about saving the world and solving America's problems. Suddenly, a spider descends that's been affected by radioactivity, bites a teenage guy, and suddenly he's woe is me. I have to, like, save the world and try to finish high school and try to find a girlfriend and try to help my Aunt May, who's adopted me. I have so much guilt and angst. It's like, my life sucks. And so it's the hero as martyr. At the same time, it's a shift from the idea of I, this sense of I as an individual, I am an outsider, to a we mindset. To take the role as martyr, and I'm going to also use my power and my ability for the greater good, because that is my responsibility as a person, and I am gifted with these special skills and special powers to be able to do that, and so that's my responsibility. So the metaphor I see there from a cultural point of view, interpreting Spider-Man, Hulk, Fantastic Four, those characters really see that responsibility that they have to society and to use their powers for good in spite of the burden of being a superhero.
Well, and stressing the collective over the individual, not real strong in the American folklore, if you will.
Right. As far as our iconic characters are often cowboys. This idea of manifest destiny, and we're gonna take over the world, and it's our right to do that. In a sense, yes, we do have a responsibility to collective good, and that is a frontier mindset as well. But there's individuality, my property, my house, my things, and this idea that we have this responsibility to each other, which is actually celebrated quite often in the Marvel Universe.
And how is that reflected in the toys here? We're seeing almost, to an untrained eye, a combination here of the last two sections of toys where there was grotesque monster and previous to that there were human forms. Now we have a lot of monster, if you will, coloration and faces, but a little bit more human body.
Well, so you're right. What we have here is villains and heroes that are now cursed. So you've got the Thing, who is one of Marvel's iconic figures. And he's a monster, and he's a hero, and he doesn't want to be a monster. He wishes he could be cured of his affliction. But unfortunately, he's got to do the right thing and go out with the Fantastic Four all the time and do good. Now, he could stay home and sob about it and whine and cry, but he doesn't. And then you've got sort of the Lizard is in here. He's a Spider-Man villain, and the Lizard is a guy who's trying to do good and turns into a lizard, sort of a Jekyll and Hyde thing going on there. And he's cursed as well, and Spider-Man has to help him undo the curse. The beauty of the Marvel Universe was it was so colorful. It was so bright to my eyes as a kid. And the fact that the characters seemed even bigger and more robust and more gigantic than the DC Universe. They were telling stories that were both interactive because the Marvel Universe from an early time worked together. In the DC Universe, nobody ever crossed paths. You could never have your adventures overlap. Here, the adventures would happen from one issue to another. You could envision Spider-Man meeting the Hulk. You could envision, you know, guys from this part of the world meeting guys from that part of the world. And, of course, like I said, the toys were just great for battle. You got big, larger-than-life characters that were maybe grotesque and some are heroic, and they got beat up, and they won, and they came back for more. And that was the exciting part about this kind of world.
And in a way, we're almost seeing stages of growing up in each of these. Back in the beginning, where it's the big bugs, you're highly imaginative, you're scared of who knows what's under the bed. Then you are hiding your true self. Then you're embracing your true self. Then you realize that you have to do something good with your true self. And so this is just becoming an adult. So now, where are we going as we head over into this next era, myths and legends, how Star Wars saved America.
What we had in the late 1970s was a kind of a chaotic society. We had a lot of unrest. We had a lot of political and social movements that were coming forward, but they were all very fragmented. We had a president that had recently resigned. There's a lot of chaos in our culture at that time. And George Lucas was making films at the time. He made American Graffiti, in fact. And at the same time, he started to wonder about outer space and the myths that he could bring forward, and really started to engage with and read more about Joseph Campbell. And Joseph Campbell was studied a lot of myths and legends, global myths and legends, and looked for some commonalities between the myths and legends that exist around the world. So as George Lucas started to read more about Joseph Campbell and actually met Joseph Campbell, he started to think about weaving that into a space fantasy. He had done a space fantasy movie before, but it wasn't very popular, and it was pretty two-dimensional and kind of boring. And once he wove in these Joseph Campbell myths, these universal ideas of good and evil and Oedipal and all these kind of stories, once he wove that in, that became this iconic universal sense of good and evil, this sense of truth, this sense of pursuit of a universal goal of happiness and embracing something that we can all wrap our heads around, that we can all get behind as a society that's very fragmented. We feel like we can unify behind these universal sense of good and evil. And that's what Star Wars then produced, is the story of all of us coming together in spite of the chaos of our society, in spite of the fragmentation. Suddenly we have this idea that we are in this together as a society, and in spite of our differences, we can come together and search for this ultimate truth. And with that, we found the Force.
And obviously, we got some big-time toys out of Star Wars. Oh, man.
So the great thing from being the master collector was, in the early 70s, toys kind of hit a gray lull, because suddenly, with the end of the Vietnam War, conflict and all that kind of, you know, battle of guys battling was passé. People didn't want to look at that anymore. You had anti-heroes. You had Clint Eastwood. You had Charles Bronson. You had guys that were vigilante cops. And so the idea of a costumed hero or a do-gooder seemed like passé. Like, that was naive. That was silly. We don't do that anymore. And then toys hit that. I mean, I remember being a collector, going, what is there to buy? There's no excitement going on. And then Star Wars comes out. And, of course, the toys are lagging behind because nobody expected it to be humongous. And then suddenly we're all scrambling to get Star Wars toys. We're all raging around. And then everyone else looks up like going, wait, what? Huh? And they go, all we need is a larger-than-life story in a galaxy far away that doesn't have anything to do with us, because then we're not promoting conflict like here. We're promoting this great epic adventure in another place and time. And so suddenly you've got Masters of the Universe, you've got the Thundercats, you've got the Power Lords, you've got the Sektars, you've got Crystar and the Lava Lords, and you've got Dungeons & Dragons is coming out at that time. And it's all about, let's create a big pantheon of collectible characters. Let's have good guys and bad guys, and you've got to have them all. You got to have them all, and you want the full set. And I was lucky enough to be able to collect multiple sets of multiple things, and so that's why they're all living here, waiting to be oodnawed of. You'll recognize somebody in this case.
Well, we have covered a lot of ground about how these toys have changed. Where are we going from here?
The future of toys is kind of an interesting conundrum. Screens are ubiquitous. We have AI. We almost don't know who we are without having a screen before us. Our decision-making is almost compromised. And yet, all over the world, kids are grabbing a stick or a cup or a rock, and they're telling stories with each other all over the world. And so our imaginations, I think, really can remain vital and vibrant the more that we actually get away from a pre-prescribed narrative that we find in gaming, and we actually can create our own storylines. So we think that the toys that live on the shelves in stores exist because kids take and buy those toys and then play on their desktops, in their backyard, in the dirt, in their school desk when the teacher isn't looking. And that's where imagination is. Imagination cannot be suppressed. It cannot be controlled. And I think the more that we have imagination as a part of our society, and the more we understand each other, the more we can work out our anxieties or our problems or our sense of powerlessness through an imaginative way, we're actually going to get along better in the world.
At some point, you just can't beat storytelling, human connection, and the tactile experience.
And so one more thing as we're seeing as a trend is we're seeing more people represented in more powerful ways. In the opening, when we first meet Rey in the new Star Wars movie, she's running through the sand, and Finn tries to grab her hand, and she says, "Stop trying to grab my hand." Like, women don't need men in order to be who they are. So that's one of the messages. Women are strong and independent. They are complementary, and we're seeing a lot more people of color, obviously Black Panther and others, are really being celebrated, so that invites more people across the diaspora of America into these stories and invites more people into these stories because they can see themselves in the characters that are on the screen, in the book, or in the toys.
I'll ask just one last question. You know, you get to a certain age and people really start to frown upon people having toys or dressing up like Superman or talking about toys. After a while, society starts to kind of wonder, how did you stay smart enough to not care about that and to feel joy?
I guess because I just love the toys. I just was so passionate about being the guy that created the haven for toys, the Shangri-La. I wanted them all to be safe, and I never found the need to stop collecting. The hardest moments for collector, as me, the collector, was when I was about 17 to 22. That was the weirdest thing, because you're in college and you're still collecting toys, and then there's girls and there's your friends, and they're going, "What are you doing with all this junk in your room?" And you're going, "I'm collecting it." And then you get to be about 30 and people are kind of just scratching their head going, "Well, all right, okay, I guess so." And by the time you get to be my age now, it's like, "Cool, I wish I'd done that. Oh my God, why didn't I save my stuff?" I get more comments like, "I had that, I wrecked it. I had that, I burned it. I had that, I shot it. I had that, I threw it away." Constantly. This is like, again, sort of the safe haven for toys to have made it. And now everyone gets to enjoy it. And I'm not going to stop collecting. I can't see it for any future time when I will stop collecting. It's still too cool, and there's too much new stuff, and there's too many venues to go, "Oh, that is so cool."
Foresight is your superpower.
I'm glad you said that. You know, I mean, there have been other people that have said different things, but I'm glad I've got all this stuff, and I'm glad now that it's going to be appreciated.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
All right. We're glad you're here. Come on down and see cool toys.
That was David Barnhill and Stephen Roof, co-creators of Super Monster City, which is on display through January in Moorhead. Coming up next, Thrifting with Intention.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. It's a busy shopping day, and it's not for everyone. Some people don't want to battle the crowds. For others, it's budget concerns. Some prefer to make their gifts by hand. And then there's the environment to consider. The fashion industry, in particular, those that make clothes that don't last, are major polluters. For Ashley Deedon Carlson, all of those reasons keep her buying used at thrift stores instead of new from major retailers. Randy Kay hosts the Simple Self-Care podcast, and she spoke with Deedon Carlson of Remade to Remember about thrifting with intention and how she made a career of it.
My parents weren't, I guess, what would be called eco-friendly or anything, but they weren't raised with a lot of money, and so they had to be really resourceful. So I remember ever since I was little, my mom especially, because she was so creative, just picking up on all these fun little things that they would do and techniques. How do we make do with what we have, right? And so when I got really interested in making my own clothing as a teenager, it was like common sense for me to use clothes that I already had and cut them up. I wasn't ever thinking about upcycling or refashioning or like this type of eco-friendly, sustainable approach to fashion at that age. But it was just like this very intuitive thing. I went to Catholic school, so I had to wear a uniform all the time. It was khakis and a polo. And I just remember like wanting so bad to have my own personality in terms of my clothing and stuff, and just really wanting to be able to like wear things that felt like me, and like not seeing that reflected in stores. When you're a teenager or in your early teens, like you are literally, you live in your little bedroom, your own little world, and you do your little things. And so it was like my only option for doing that and expressing myself through my clothing was by literally like cutting up bed sheets that I already had.
This just reminds me of Sound of Music, just like making clothes out of curtains.
Yeah. And like, no, absolutely. That's what I would do. And then when I did get my license and I discovered thrift stores, my like mind was blown because I was like, oh my gosh, these vintage sheets have this beautiful floral pattern and I can use this to make a dress out of. And I don't have to steal any more of my brother's elastic underwear bands. To like,
no, you
did. Oh, I did. Yeah. I totally did. And never like my entire like life, like I've always been a like ask for forgiveness, not for permission type of person, you know? So yeah. I would just like literally rip up clothes and rip up my brother's clothes. And it was the underwear band
that finally,
yeah, where my parents were like, okay, like, do we need to take you to like the fabric store? And I'm like, no, this totally works. And they're like, well, your brother needs underwear. So like, I'm like, yeah, but like, what about the ones he doesn't need anymore?
And knowing your brother, it wasn't the most sanitary.
No, it was not a smart, I mean, like it was clever, right? But it was also just like wildly unnecessary, you know? That's just the way that I've always done things. And the way that I still do things. It's like, yeah, there's probably an easier way to do this. But what do I have access to at this moment? What can I be creative with at this moment? That bled into everything that I did. And then when I got to college, I started to realize, wait a minute, like all those decisions I was making out of necessity actually were also making a positive environmental impact. I didn't even recognize, I think in those early like teenage years, wait a minute, why do all of these clothes exist? Why can I go to a thrift store and have there be full shelves of clothing that nobody's wearing, or they bought it and they wore it once and now it's here? And I became much more aware of the element of waste that is so prevalent in the fashion industry. Got even more passionate about approaching those creative projects from that point. It became like a more political thing where it was, I'm doing this not because I'm too young to drive and can't go shopping at wherever you would shop in the early 2000s, but I'm doing this because I don't want to create more of a demand for something that already exists. That's the underlying element that drives my husband's work. He does reclaimed and then urban salvage wood, which urban salvage means trees that are cut down along boulevards and streets in your town. They usually end up in the landfill. It was the same type of outrage. What? Why? Why? I have a sawmill. I can take that material and turn it into something new. It doesn't need to be wasted. I think when you do gain an awareness of food waste or like within the textile industry or wood or whatever, you can't help but wonder, well, what can I do? What decisions can I make? So ideologically, I've always operated from that space. And I think as a couple, my husband and I do, but we have such a far ways to go in our personal lives too. We live in a culture where like we're so surrounded by this idea that there's a right way or a perfect way to do things. And like, we have to be a perfect zero waste person, or we have to be an ideal environmentalist, or we have to be vegan, and doing just a little bit isn't good enough. But massive change is not going to happen by everybody being perfect. Everybody just has to do what they can. Today, I ran to Hornbacher's because I am a new mom and like did not have time to make myself lunch. Ended up getting lunch that was packaged in plastic, in a plastic bag. But on the other hand, I'm a vegetarian. Does the carbon emissions that I offset from not eating meat make up for the fact that sometimes I'm a jerk and get plastic wrap food? I don't know. The areas that I can excel in, or the areas that I can make an impact in, those are the places that I can speak to. I literally cannot tell you the last time I bought a new article of clothing.
And I think that's really important because we are so focused on what we need to keep doing in all areas that we don't realize what we are doing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this uprising of eco-anxiety, especially with young people. They're really afraid
of
where our world is going. Yeah. And I talk to people, they don't even know where to start because they're like, this isn't even going to make a dent. Fish are still going to have straws coming out of their eyeballs, you know, and all this kind of scare tactics, which are needed. Yeah. But we don't value the importance of day to day. And the fact that you always get your clothes from thrift stores is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious, because I've gone thrifting with you.
Mm-hmm. And yes, you have, Randy.
And it's so much fun because you've got your systems, you've got your tips and your tricks and where you go for this and where you go for that. And I think a lot of people get overwhelmed with thrifting where they don't think that it could be for them.
Right.
So do you have any tips on how to start?
Get to know the thrift stores in the area. So I think that's like one of the biggest tips. I got to know the thrift stores in Fargo because that was my cost of goods, right? That was my supply chain. So I was going to every thrift store in the area to buy piles and piles and piles of men's button-down shirts, which I got a lot of weird looks about, to then take to the laundromat to wash, which I also got a lot of weird looks about, to turn into my end product. And through that process of going, I started to realize, oh, well, this thrift store is really good for, and of course, I'm shopping for my business, but I'm also looking at shoes, the books, and the housewares, everything. And I started to recognize, like, this thrift store has awesome tablecloths and linens or whatever. And this thrift store always has really cool furniture. And this thrift store is great for, they get all of Target's old clothes every month. And recognize the strengths of each thrift store, because it's so true. I think a lot of people, they'll go into one thrift store and it's usually like the jankiest one that they, you know, out of all of them. And they're like, this is gross, right? But even in a small community like Fargo, there are 12 solid individual thrift stores.
You took me to one that like I didn't know existed. It was on some weird side road. And it was my favorite one. It had like the coolest kitchen stuff.
I'm trying to think of which one it was. Oh, New Life Center. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And they'd have bag sales where you could fill an entire bag for like $5. Mm-hmm. Don't judge all thrift stores for like the one weird experience you had. Go to all of the ones that you can, and you'll find that different places have different strengths. And then, of course, there are always going to be things that, like, you don't want to get from a thrift store, right? Like, you're not going to get underwear.
Underwear, Ashley, yeah. Don't get those waistbands.
You're not going to get the waistbands from the underwear at the thrift store, even though the elastic's probably still totally good. Maybe there's some other use for it. I usually steer clear of appliances, and now that we live in, like, a Facebook marketplace world, for my son, when it came time to start making food for him, I had read so much about these little food cookers, and I was like, cool, I'll keep an eye out at the thrift stores, and, of course, never found them. Looked on Facebook Marketplace and there were a million of them. There are probably things that you can buy secondhand that, like, yeah, you can add it to your, I'll keep an eye out at the thrift stores, but we also have other resources. But clothing is like the main thing that I think people underestimate. If you just think about how quickly you go through clothing, the average American, it's all quantity. They're shopping every week, they're buying new things. Those things usually end up at thrift stores and they've usually been worn only once or twice. And so, like, I think in our heads, we think, like, oh, this is just going to be some raggedy, old, gross sweater that is from somebody's grandpa. What it actually is like, some high-end label, especially depending on where you're thrift shopping, some high-end label that somebody bought, wore to an event, and donated afterwards.
Yeah, I was at a thrift store recently, and I found a Pendleton sweater.
Yeah.
And it was awesome, and all I needed to do was take it to the dry cleaner to get cleaned up a little bit, it happened to be the day where the tag color was half off.
Yeah.
So I got it for $20.
Yeah, that's
awesome. And then maybe spent $10 with dry cleaning, if that.
Right.
And then it was a new sweater. And I think the key for me as I've been getting more into it is to go with some clear intentions. Because the other thing that Americans are trying to do is, if it's a good price, why not?
Yes.
It's only $5.
I will be totally honest with you, Randy. The first time I went thrifting with you, you had like a full cart and I had like no things, right? So Randy's just going nuts, right? And you're grabbing like all these different like housewares, and it's like all really cute stuff, but I also was like, dang, girl, slow down. Because, like, I very much am, like, a hesitant shopper, and, like, I didn't inherit that, like, oh, it's cheap, so I'm gonna, not that it's cheap, but it's affordable, right? So, like, it's not, who cares? It's, like, $4, right?
Yeah.
And, but I do remember being like, Mandy. Oh, really? Which I think, like, you, since that point, and, but you were probably like, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I got such a good deal on all of these things.
I was totally guilty of it. Yeah. And I've wised up.
Yeah.
Since then. But.
You did not have an intention set.
No, I was just going,
yeah, you're like,
you.
This is so cool.
And I'm like, look at this. Oh, cute. And so I am, the things I go to thrift stores for is I am trying to add some new sweaters to my collection for the winter. And so that was cool that I found that sweater because I was looking for it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I need like plates or cups or like when I'm at my studio and I need more cups or something,
mm-hmm.
I cannot believe how nice dishes like get donated and things. And so I like to find cute little faces and things there. Having clear intentions of what you're wanting. And also, even if something is cool, thinking, what am I actually going to do with this?
Will I use this?
Yeah.
I even believe if you have your heart set on, I really need a new pair of such and such, to just carry that idea with you. If you are being thoughtful about it. And also keeping in mind, like, I'm glad you mentioned that sweater, because the quality of the items that you're buying is also important. So what you don't want to do is start using the thrift store like a rent a runway.
Yeah.
You don't want to just be like, oh, well, this shirt's $2, so I'm just going to get it and then I'll just donate it again. Think about like the long-term life of your items. The more that you can keep clothes out of the landfill, the better. But I think it's a sticky situation to get into, which I am getting so much better at. That was like sort of my, especially as a teenager, oh, cool, I got this dress for $3 and I'm going to wear it for like a month and then I'll just donate it again. And I always have new clothes. But then it also was this kind of like short-term type of relationship that is better than buying something totally new, but also like not as mindful.
The other thing I've learned from talking to people that own thrift stores and work at thrift stores is they have to process so much crap from us. And even if it's something they will use and sell, it's still a lot of work for them to process all the stuff we're giving them. And I know thrift stores that they take a huge dumpster to the landfill every day.
Right. It's part of a chain. It's not just a Band-Aid, right? And the same when we were talking about these little things, it's always better to bring a reusable bag, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's always going to be better. Is that going to, like, stop climate change in and of itself? Absolutely not. But it's a decision that you can make that is simple. When you forget your bag, you don't have to beat yourself up. Like, we're all human. It's a decision worth making. And if it can be made, it's, like, just make it.
And I just really admire how you and your husband have turned your passions and hobbies into now how you run your family and how you want to be as a family unit and your future plans. And that's the thing about any of these little things that we take on. We're not going to have it be this huge lifestyle at first, but you just keep doing it and it gets to evolve over time. And you would never be where you're at right now if you didn't start somewhere. And this is the long game, you know?
Yeah.
And it makes a difference.
Yeah. It changes so much too when you do start a family. On the one hand, I'm thinking like, holy crap, my kid that I made the decision to bring into this world is going to have to live on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
How do I prepare them to navigate it in a thoughtful way? Your choices have an added level of consideration to them. The learning process follows no matter what. I was just patching Seth's jeans the other day, thinking about patching Alden's jeans one day.
Mm-hmm.
He will be taught when something is broken, we don't throw it away, we try to fix it. And those little things that don't seem like much can amount to something so much bigger.
One thing I'd like to end on, so right now you're preparing a curriculum for young people for repurposing clothing and upcycling. What is the main message you want them to understand? Because that's probably what we all need to understand.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, I'm so excited about this program. It's called Fashion Remix. Oh, I just think about if I had access to this type of experience when I was in my bedroom teaching myself how to sew, if I ended up where I am without that type of exposure to these ideas, I can't even imagine where I could have been. This whole entire program, 6 weeks, is all focused on ways that they can use fashion to express themselves in a really accessible way. So I think the overall message is that it's accessible. That form of creative expression, fashion, or you could even take it into your home and your home decor. Like, those type of things are accessible. It doesn't have to be complicated. It's accessible. I'll start with a plain white t-shirt, dye it, and stamp it, and alter it, and turn it into something that's totally unique. Instilling that creative spark of what can I do with what I have? Because I feel like it all comes back to that.
And I think it also brings in the point that when we do pause and work with what we've got, we realize we have a lot.
So much.
Thank you, Ashley. We'll have you back on soon.
Awesome. I look forward to it.
That was Randy Kay, host of the Simple Self-Care Podcast, talking with Ashley Deedon Carlson of Remade to Remember. You can find out more at naturallyrandyk.com and remadetoremember.com.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 29th. Arguably, the greatest U.S. invention in the 1800s was the railroad, because railways tied the nation together, building commerce across the land. If a town had a railway, it had life. Conversely, if a town did not get a railway, it died. One of the towns that sprang forth with railroad life was Larimore, 28 miles west of Grand Forks. The town owed its existence to Oscar M. Towner, who came to Dakota from Missouri in 1878. He had persuaded investors from St. Louis to establish the Elk Valley Bonanza Farm in Grand Forks County. Two of those investors, Newell G. Larimore and John W. Larimore, were honored in 1881 when the township and town were named after them. Bright prospects for Larimore were on the horizon, for the Great Northern Railway was building west from Grand Forks in 1881. The track laying reached the town site on November 22nd, when there were only 30 people in Larimore. As in other Dakota locations, the boom began like lightning hitting the earth. The hype for Larimore's boom was hyperactive, with Larimore called the most booming town of the most booming valley of the most booming territory of the most booming nation of the most booming continent of the most booming world of the universe, making Larimore the frisky center of all abstract and concrete reality. The grandiose language continued as the farmland surrounding Larimore was said to make it truly the poor man's paradise. The location was like the long-lost Garden of Eden, minus the apple trees and snakes. These words echoed what a father allegedly told his child. If I told you once, I told you 8 million times. Don't exaggerate. Soon after the railroad tracks reached Larimore's town site, a locomotive chugged into the boomtown. It was on this date, in 1881, that the Grand Forks Herald reported that the first regular train had arrived in Larimore with 10 carloads of lumber for building the railway depot. Trains were scheduled to run every day to Larimore from Grand Forks. By the spring of 1882, it had become a town of 500 people. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Dr. Stephen Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.